Blog Talk Radio.
Yes, that is Watermelon Man by Pancho Sanchez. Once again, it's that time on the K Thompson Live Show. My name is Eric. I am the son, as you know, of Eric Payne.
And I'm K Thompson, everyone, and welcome to K Thompson Live.
We also are going to have our other host, Mr. Wayne Gilman, will be calling in shortly.
Yes, and what Wayne is going to be doing, he's going to be giving us an update on the funeral arrangements for Dr. Ben. And so as soon as he calls in, we will have him on the air. But, you know, we've been doing some hot stories on, you know, today. As you all know by now, there was a murder committed in South Carolina. And it seems that a man was shot in the back when he was running from this policeman. And it's amazing because of the fact that this cop felt that he could get away with it. And I'm quite sure everyone has seen the video by now. Why he thought he could do it, I don't know. Also, they know about this 2 days ago. But the policeman shot the young man in the back, I think it was 7 or 8 times, and he calmly walked to pick up something and put it down. He didn't realize, however, that it was being taped. It was being videotaped, I think, by a young, maybe teenager or somebody. But anyway, all of this was on the on film, and it's all over the airwaves. So, you know, we're really not telling you anything new, but we're going to keep you up to date on this. In fact, you know, you get a little tired of hearing all this because of the fact that this thing, Eric Gardner from Staten Island, okay, New York, he was shot because he was selling what cigarettes. And that was a, an awful kind of thing. There's also Michael Brown in Ferguson. And then there was this little kid who was pointed a toy gun. So, and so many things have happened.
Right, as we know, I just want to interject a point of clarification. We know that Eric Gardner was not shot. He was strangled.
Right.
Okay.
In a chokehold.
Right.
All right. So, but anyway, let's continue with this. So many things have happened. I remember the Amadou Diallo case, and where over 40 shots was administered, or the police used guns to shoot this young man going into his house. Rodney King, okay, so many people. Rudy Buchanan out in the state of Arizona. Lost one of his sons that way, and by the state police also. There was a case in Buffalo, New York. There was also a case of a homeless person down in Columbia, South Carolina. So we're wondering when this is going to stop. However, it would be a good idea, as a matter of fact, people should demand that all police should probably wear body cams, okay, showing their movements and whenever they go out on a case because of the fact that a lot of them cannot be dressed. As a matter of fact, we all know that the police department, many of them in the police department who are white, are not only afraid of black people, but they will do damage to black people. For instance, if you see the case of Trayvon Martin, now that wasn't done, yes, it was done by someone who called himself Army.
No, let's be clarified that he was not a police officer.
I was getting ready to
say
that.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. And he was not, of course, and as I was getting ready to say, that he was patrolling his neighborhood. Same kind of thing, however. He got off and he murdered this kid. I don't know when it's going to stop because it is annoying and it is upsetting. And if I sound a little bit more emotional than usual, well, you know, it's
right.
About time we did something really, really about this.
Right.
Never let it happen again. We have to demonstrate whatever we have to do, we have to do it.
Right. And just like I said, for clarification, the thing is that you get emotional and clarification. What's his face? Zimmerman was on a patrol, individual patrol. He did try to be a police officer, but the two are separate. So we want to make sure we make that stipulation that he was not a police officer. But clearly, it's been being done since really the beginning of the United States for a long time that black men are obviously and black people. Obviously, what the whole slavery thing, we don't
right.
need to go back that far, but even up until the civil rights era and things like that, the people of color are getting executed. And they seem to be at the hands of, you said, many police officers. We don't want to say all. We want to clarify that as well. But it does get to be a little bit redundant and tiresome. That is something that these rogue individuals that seem to get welcomed into the police force, and it does seem to be in certain police forces, as in certain communities, that reflect the values of certain communities, or at least those of members of that community that might be in the power position, that want to promote somewhat a racist agenda, or certainly an agenda that practices unfair practices in terms of how they administer law and order on the darker or minority members of the community. And there was a study out just the other day, I wish I could get the statistics, where how people, it was on one of the MSNBC shows, how they did a poll sampling of the percentage of people that think our minorities treated more harshly, no more harshly, or fairly by the police officers. Of course, the largest number of percentage of the group that thought minorities were treated more harshly was 50%. That was black people. Mm-hmm. Coming second by Hispanics was, I think the number was around 30% that mm-hmm. that community that thought that the minorities were treated more harshly. And of Asians, it was a small number. White people, it was only 20% that thought that minorities were treated more harshly than other groups, while 75% or something like that, a large number, thought that everybody was treated fairly. So there clearly is a perspective of how we all view things as it relates to minority issues and obviously the killing of the police. I see that we have a caller. Hold on, caller. I see you at the 646. But we also at this moment want to welcome our co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman. Wayne.
Hi, good evening. How are you doing, Eric? And Kay?
Fine. How are you doing, Wayne?
Okay. You know, I guess like everyone else, we're a little distraught by the news of the latest incident involving the police department and people of color.
Yes, we are. It seems like it's something to stop.
Yeah, I mean, I've talked to so many people today about it. I mean, it's just sad. I mean, we have done this time and again. You think that it just comes to an end at some point, but it's really despicable behavior. I don't know what it's going to take. I want to feel at some point that this country will eventually turn the clock and start, you know, realizing that we're all human. And it shouldn't be a situation where people are treated like as if they're animals because they're of a different color, you know? Go ahead, Eric.
Now, I was going to say, Carla, we're going to get you in on this discussion, too, in a minute. I'm going to open your mic. But I was going to say, you know, really, when they talk about when people try to come to bring resolutions, people have had conflict and things like that, or people that have gone through addiction and they go through a program, one of the things you have to do is make amends to the people that you've wronged. And there is a society that has wronged a group of people, and that is the American society that has wronged people of color. And the hardest brunt of that has been felt by African Americans. There's no doubt about it. There's no questioning those facts. Happens is that when you have individuals in the other community, the larger community, who would rather would just say that that doesn't exist, or they refuse to acknowledge that. So what happens is that that community is not willing to make amends, or at least certain individuals in that community, and certainly it seems like the majority of the power structure is not willing to make amends to say, yes, that happened, but here we go. And from a current modern-day white person's perspective, and you start talking about the wrongs of black people and stuff, of course their response, they take it personal and individual, and they say, well, you know, on their response, and this has been the response of some people I've heard, I've never done that. I haven't put you in slavery. No, you haven't, but possibly your ancestors may have, and possibly that they bought, even if they didn't, they bought into a society, a structure of society, and that made it okay for people to be enslaved. And if at times for people to speak up, I'm talking going back to slavery times, and even in the civil rights era, if you're a white individual, it could have meant your death and you were putting your life on the line. So that would be, my perspective, understandable if you're trying to survive. But when you thrive off of a society that makes you the preferred citizen, you get preferred status, like you see those credit cards, makes you the preferred citizen, then you must at least recognize that there is an unfairness there. And when you don't, that means that you're not willing to meet people halfway and at least say, you know, I understand your point of view, but you have to be willing to come to the table. That's how people get along and people come along and are able to survive in a society.
You know, also what's going to be happening is that, you know, people are going to get so sick and tired. It's going to get beyond the stage or the of the demonstrations, okay? And we don't want that to happen. But I will say, giving credit to a caller who called into Joe Madison's show today, I understand, Lisa was telling me, that there was a neighbor who had videotaped this, as I was mentioning before. And what had happened was that they went over to the family of the man who was shot, and his name was Walter Scott, I think. And they told the family that that what had happened, and then also then they took it from there. The family, they notified the police department, but it was known for 2 days. I'm amazed that no one, you know, really reported on that for 2 days. Now, if I'm wrong, somebody will call. Somebody will call to correct me. However, this is what we heard, and that's what Lisa said she heard on Joe Madison. So we're glad that someone called with that information, because had a neighbor not filmed this, not videotaped this, okay, we never would have known about what happened. That's an example of what's going on with some of these policemen. And I'll tell you another thing. I think it may be a little more organized than not with some members of the police department in this country.
Maybe so.
Okay? So I'm not going to put that out there, but I am putting it out there.
Okay. We're going to open the mic. Go ahead, Wayne.
Go ahead. No, I was just going to chime in and say that, you know, I don't want to feel that this is a deliberate act, but, you know, the bottom line is that the beauty of what is going on today with the modern technology is that we are in a position to memorialize a lot of this stuff that is happening, because had it been a situation where it was not documented, you know, had Eric Garner had not been documented, you know, where we couldn't see over and over again, as painful as it may be, you know, we would still be here guessing and basically speculating as to, well, who did what. You know, they wouldn't have been able to come immediately and bring about a decision on this cop's case in the Walter Scott case. But getting back to what you were saying, Eric, I you know, it's funny, you touched on the subject. I was talking to a friend of mine who's happened to be married to a white woman and had been married for a number of years. And the deal is, you know, he called me today and said that, you know, regardless of what goes on, there may be a degree of understanding by progressive whites, but the vast majority of them, regardless of what they may have witnessed, just don't get it the way we get it. That's the problem. And the thing is that it's costing this country, the level of racism that goes on in this country is costing the economy. And I want to think that each generation that passes, that there is a degree of acceptance and understanding that people are coming together. But at the same time, you have incidents like this, and you know, it's just that there are certain corners of the American culture that it's so ingrained, you know, that we're not going to, it's going to probably take another lifetime before we see an ultimate change in the pattern which, you know, basically what the white American culture has been all about. This is what it's been founded on.
You know, and another thing, Wayne, the bottom line, and we're going to go to that 718 number in a minute, excuse me, but the bottom line is, you know, in order to really change things, we have to get really very, very aware, become aware of politics, of what you can do to straighten it out, to help it. Get out and vote, put people in who's going to treat the community fairly. Okay?
Yeah.
I want to thank the people who called into Joe Madison today, or else we never would have known about the person who, you know, videotaped this. So shall we go to this other caller?
Yeah, caller, 646 number. Hello, caller.
Yes. Yeah, hi. This is Richard Wesley.
Hey, Richard Wesley, how you doing, sir? How are you?
I'm doing fine. How's everybody?
Well, okay. Richard, I know you definitely have an opinion. Richard Wesley, world-famous, let me give you a prop. World-famous screenwriter, one of the most prolific movies of our time. I was going to say black movies, but movies, period. Certainly black classics that people of my age and younger grew up on, and even older. Playwright extraordinaire, and New Jersey and Montclair resident, and also
yes.
You're a professor as well, I believe. Is that correct, sir?
Yes, I am. I'm a professor over at New York University, yes. Yeah, you're talking, I was listening to the conversation, and indeed, the video does exist. The young man who shot it lived right there in the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
And he was interviewed within the past several hours by Lester Holt on NBC.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so his video, from what he was saying, not only did he go take it to the family, but they also supplied it to they before it went to the police. I think it actually went to the press. No doubt they wanted to make sure that the video got out and that there wasn't an attempt to suppress it. So it actually got out to the press first, and then once that happened, a copy of it got to the police department, and the police department immediately took the measures that they took in terms of stripping the officer of his badge and gun and placing him under arrest. And like everyone else, we want to see what happens after that.
Yeah.
I'm concerned. I'm concerned about the charge of murder, because we've seen, what happens when that particular charge. I mean, the heaviest and the most onerous charge, homicide charge that you can bring, and usually. Apropos some other aspects of the conversation that you were having, that's also the hardest charge to get to.
Mm-hmm.
Murder, first degree murder with malicious forethought. Why in the world would a veteran police officer just suddenly draw his gun and shoot down an unarmed man without provocation? And something must have happened. And that video, while it's very graphic and everything, it doesn't pick up all the audio, so we don't really know what that poor man may have said to the police officer to escalate the situation. And you can imagine a defense lawyer throwing all kinds of doubts into the situation. And
mm-hmm.
I guess my feeling is sometimes when the charge is something slightly less, like negligent homicide or reckless manslaughter, those kinds of charges, I feel like you can get those to stick because the evidence is there that proves those charges without a doubt. Trying to bring in a murder charge all of that, and trying to get inside someone, trying to prove what the officer was thinking at the moment that he drew his gun and pulled the trigger, that's very hard to do, and that's the kind of out that a lot of juries would be looking for in order to...
I can't help but feel that it had to be malicious intent. He was shot 8 times. The gentleman was running away from the police officer, and he was shot in the back. I mean, what more do you need? I mean,
officer said he, unless they say they're fear for their lives, I was in shock. I don't remember what I did. I saw the video. Some of it is clear to me. Some of it is not. Michael Wilson was huge. and he was coming at Michael Brown was huge, and he was coming at Darryl Wilson like King Kong, and
right.
Darryl Wilson was feared for his life. You know, that's all you have to say.
And
I feared for my life. You know, or he.
But
we
have no definitive empirical and graphic information on that. It's all speculative. You know, this thing is dead on.
This is great.
I mean,
this is visual and graphic. It's absolutely. You're absolutely right about that. But you know, Eric Garner was visual
exactly.
and graphic,
and
God
and
bless
Staten
him.
Island
so was
had the history.
You know. Yeah, you know, and so was Rodney King, and you know, but I think also if I can, you know, wax slightly optimistic here, what if, you know, this issue now, the Black Lives Matter movement, because that's what it is now, it's a national movement that you know, that these wonderful young people have taken over. There's a whole new civil rights generation, and this is the new civil rights movement. And I think that it is going to have a positive outcome. It's unfortunate so many deaths have occurred, but the last civil rights movement was an outgrowth of the age, you know, that late 19th century, early 20th century age of terror. Terrorism, you know, domestic terrorism that we had to live through. And, you know, we saw, you know, Du Bois and Garvey and you know, the NAACP and so many other individuals and organizations, it emerged out of that. And perhaps now it's well over 100 documented police shootings of unarmed black men and women, and in a couple of cases, children. You know, that to me is a major indictment of law enforcement in this country, and people are now starting to have to come to terms with it. It's not just, you know, random incidences here and there. This is now something that looks, I think, in fact, you all mentioned it just a few minutes ago. This is looking like something like a national epidemic. It's either an indictment of poor training. It's an indictment of poor hiring practices, bringing, homicidal sociopaths onto the police force, literally giving them badges and guns and a license to kill. You know, and it has to be addressed. And people are starting to address it. People are starting to complain about it loudly and vociferously. And, you know, and this video, this is the second video now in less than a year that has come out and showed in graphic illumination the murder, the killing of an unarmed black civilian by white police officers who it then turns out have a history of complaints against them, previous altercations with civilians. The one in Staten Island and this one here in South Carolina. These cops have previous histories.
All right, Richard, what is really going to be happening is that the things are going to be getting, I mean, it's getting bad now, okay? But I think we're going to be seeing more demonstrations, and we're going to be seeing we may be seeing new insurrections with, you know, the black community, the Latino community, the Asian community taking up armed weapons, and everybody, you know, having their own weapon and using them, and that's dangerous, and it's all based on racism. Period. Okay, if we can get rid of that, maybe people can sit down and talk. But as a parent, you know, and with a son. you know, it just makes you so angry that you want to tell them, listen, let's get the gun, get ready. I was reading the book by Huey Newton. She was so sick and tired of, you know, being sick and tired that they formed their own organization. And what happened was that
well, yes, you know, no, I remember all of this, but, you know, I just think, you know, because of what's happening, I think that there are people, certainly there are people who are thinking like that and talking like that. I've seen newspaper articles now about at least two black officials, one a lawyer and I think one is a politician out there out in the Midwest and I think Ohio and Missouri and places like that, who are talking about black people arming themselves and being prepared to defend themselves against, you know, rogue cops or whomever. But I think that it's something different that's getting you know, if it gets to that, then we're literally talking about the whole country just imploding.
Yep.
You
well,
know,
I'm talking
and about, I don't think things have gotten quite that bad. But I do believe that's what starts to happen is you start to see, continuing pressure from, you know, from inside the black community pushing outward to change these things. I mean, just last night, the all-white city council in Ferguson became half black. Because the people in the black community in Ferguson came out
vote.
And voted,
right?
And that council will probably be predominantly black, or at least more reflective of the overall size of the black population in Ferguson after the next election cycle.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the very first things that happened in the wake of everything, you know, the pressure from the community in Ferguson, you know, are the firings of these people, these various people in the city government and in the police department who have stood silently by and allowed a lot of the ugliness that happened in Ferguson to reach the point that it reached. And I'm saying that I got a feeling that ultimately, with proper organization, that same kind of pressure can have the same kind of positive results throughout the country, that this epidemic, you know, of killings is going to dissipate as more and more, you know, black people start to, you know, organize to get control of these situations. I mean, North Charleston is another town with a predominantly black population and a white power, run by a white power structure, that is, you know, affecting policies that pretty much keeps the community disenfranchised. And now you kill a 50-year-old father of four, shoot him five times in the back, and then have the nerve to walk over there and try to plant a taser next to his body.
Right.
You know, it's already been proven now that the police officer waited in an excess of 2 minutes before he checked Walter Scott's pulse.
Well, on tape. It was all on tape. I find it amazing.
Yeah,
that
it's all on tape.
He was comfortable, you know, in doing what he did. He walked
from
one place
to another.
He walked back.
Yeah, trotted over, got the taser, walked on back, dropped it right next to the body and everything.
Yeah.
And someone who's going to have to answer to a whole lot of people, unless he's hiding his face right now, is that black cop.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say.
He's
going
to have to answer a whole lot of questions.
There you go. And that goes to a different point. There's a couple of points you made that I wanted to address. But let me start by that, because on the tape, you see the white cop walk over and you see the black cop arrive on the scene. And it appeared that when Slager, whatever his name is, the criminal, it appeared that when he walked over and dropped the taser, I guess they're saying it is now, that the blackout mm-hmm. was right there. You know, the blackout
was right there.
So I'm wondering, did he not see it, or is that just a kind of a thing that they do? I mean, because you don't see him in the tape react bodily. You don't see him look up or anything like that. And it's kind of hard to see because it's blurry in the way they kept superimposing where the police officer's hand was and dropping. You can't really tell. But the one time they just ran the tape without superimposing, it didn't look like the black cop responded to this guy dropping something down.
I don't think he was there at that point.
And yeah, he was there. And it didn't look like he responded
there.
To it. Yeah, he was there.
He was there.
And so what happens is that what concerns me is that what our African American members of society, when they become the police officers, sometimes they think of themselves as just being blue as opposed to being African American before they're blue. And I point to not the sister who stood by, who was the supervising officer in the Eric Gardner situation, but it reminds me of how these police officers would turn their back on de Blasio because the idiot union chief got on de Blasio because he expressed concern about his black son in a very real environment, life and death environment towards black men. And when de Blasio would show up at these events, cops would turn their back. And on the news clips that I saw, there were black and Hispanic cops engaging in that. Now, I understand it was about also the negotiations with their pension and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's incumbent upon the African-American members, and I've met black police officers that are trying to do things to respond to this kind of epidemic, which I don't think is an epidemic. I really think it's been going on since forever. It's just now that technology allows us to have something in our hand to take it. They can't get away with it as much as possible. But I don't think anything has changed, really. They've been knocking off black people like it's all right for since we got in this country. So
yeah,
I don't think it's changed at all. I understand exactly.
I don't really dispute that. I mean, you know, the police force was organized, and at the end of the day, protect and serve property.
Exactly. And
you know that more than anything else.
So, and also with the situation where, you know, we hope that police forces can come together and we get the individuals. You know, you talked about the caliber of people that are getting hired on the police force, and that's exactly what it is. You know, it's the power structure in place that allows a certain individuals to continue to maintain. You know, all of these individuals have had claims against them for excessive force in the Eric Gardner, this particular police officer, Warren mm-hmm. Wilson. They've all had charges against them, and maybe that's kind of, I don't know how whether that's the norm with police dealing with the community, but you know, there has to be, I've said it before, that it's training. You know, a lot of us have gone to school with those
training.
People. Yeah, and a lot of us have gone to high school with people, and then years later you graduate high school, graduate college, you come back home, and you see that one dude who used to be picked on in high school, now he's a cop, you know, or the one guy who was for lack of a better term, an idiot in high school, now he's a cop. So it makes you kind of wonder, what's the training like? You know, I don't think you have to be a college graduate. I don't think that you know, there's just a lot of things that they deal with. And psychological training,
you know,
conflict resolution,
yeah.
All things I suggest.
There've already been some of these, you know, accusations made that a lot of times the best cops are not the ones who wind up, you know, in black communities. The cop who shot Tamir Rice, so incompetent that another municipality just outside Cleveland, a suburb, fired him because he was so bad. Cleveland hires him, and the first thing you know, he's inside the black community.
Right.
the cop who killed.
As you mentioned that, brother, I'm reminded of the recent case here in New York where the police officer who basically is involved, I think, in monitoring issues concerning terrorism, was caught on YouTube when it went viral about his interaction or dressing down a cab driver who was, he had such a history, but yet they found him, you know, they thought he was, a significant candidate for the kind of a task he was carrying on. And had it not been, again, memorialized and videotaped, you know, he probably would not have, he would have slipped through the cracks and something worse could have happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, other than the dress down.
Yeah, this kind of, you know, that's why I think this is like the next great civil rights movement in this country. And it's going to be about police departments. And it's going to be about, you know, their behavior, the hiring practices, the level of their training, who gets assigned where and why. You know, this level of violence, I mean, absolute violence that is unleashed against us. You know, the idea that a 12-year-old boy could be shot down in a park for playing with a toy gun, you know, and then, he was so big, I thought he was 20 years old. That's the excuse that has been given for why they fired on him. The little girl who was asleep in her bed, you know, when the police just came, you know, when the police crashed through the door and unleashed gunfire, and one of the stray bullets went through a wall and killed her. Eleanor Bumpers, what was that, 20 years ago? Still in my memory.
Yeah, that's why I said this.
It's
nothing new. And I agree with you about this is the next great revolution because the young people now are getting involved. But I submit to everybody that we have a revolutionary war that's coming up, and it's a war against racism. And we have to react actively to kill it and to make sure that everybody in this country understands that that is unacceptable behavior. If you are a person that engages in that, we will we will find you and we will correct you, put you in jail, or eradicate you from a position of authority. It's okay to believe that. If you want to be, this is a free country. You want to believe in racism on your little farm, in your little neighborhood, with the people who all look like you, that's great. But when you get down in town near the watering hole, wherever it's got to come to the watering hole, I'm breaking it down real simple, real early American, for all those people to understand. You get down to the watering hole and you start talking off about other people, then it's going to be a problem. Or if you own the watering hole, like Indiana, I'm getting gay rights now, and you decide that you don't want to serve people because they're very present in gayness, kind of messes with your whole mentality. These people that perpetuate this hate, we need to combat them and let them know. We hope that you will come to society with love and understanding. If you want to be one that chooses to hate, then go about your business in hate. But when you come into the larger public square of people, that is unacceptable behavior. And if you engage in that, you will be dealt with.
Also, when you remember the all of cases that we were subjected to here in WLIV years ago, and I'm talking about that with the allocation, a number of things, you know, and that sparked rioting. As a matter of fact, I remember a case when I was doing, I was on Geraldo's show one time. And one of the times I was on, and he had a person from Arizona, and his name was Rudy Buchanan. And he had two sons, a son, one that was killed by the state police, and a whole group of state police, and then the other one who was also, I think, shot during that particular time. So this stuff has not only started in this area, it is around the country. It is an epidemic right now. I don't know why people don't see that. It's very simple.
You can name
the different cases that have happened as a result of it. You remember the Abner Lewin case where they shot this kid, 41 times and thrown in his own house? We were on the air at that time.
That was Diallo. That was the Diallo case, yes. But Abner Lewin,
yeah.
Oh, Lord.
And still, Loretta Lynch is not appointed Attorney General. I mean, you know, I mean, the deal is that there's so much blatant racism. I sometimes want to tie it to the presidency, the fact that this country has elected its first black president, so they're going to step up the level of violence in parts of the country to show that in spite of what goes on in Washington, we're still large and in charge. But you're absolutely right. I think it
is tied, Wayne. You're absolutely right. I didn't mean to interrupt you. You're absolutely right. I'm agreeing with you 100% on that.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, I don't know why, you know, that this despicable behavior. Here it is with Loretta Lynch. And again, I don't want to get into a whole party, you know, Democrat versus Republican, situation, because I could see fault on both sides. I see sometimes when I'm a registered Democrat and we're very quiet and we don't do enough and say enough because of political expediency in certain areas, and the Republicans, you know, some of them are so ruthless that they don't just give a damn.
Go ahead, finish your thought.
The thing is, this thing with the police department, you're certainly right. It is something that is indigenous to a particular culture. It doesn't matter who they hire, black, white, and green. Once you've become ingrained and you become a member of this force, something diabolical at times. I'm not saying everyone. I don't want to paint with a broad stroke, but there's so many of them that just seem to have this feeling of empowerment. And I think it's a situation where I've said this before, behavior modification is needed for the police. But even a step further, you know, when the licensing of guns in this country has to go through more scrutiny also, because there are a lot of hotheads out here who are given license to arms, and they're just as guilty and culpable of what this cop in South Carolina did.
Yeah. Wayne, let me just take issue. I agree with you about the Obama effect vis-a-vis black men being shot, but I think it's the opposite perspective. If Barack Obama, the only reason that these things are getting as much play as they are in the media and dealt with the way they are from this black attorney general is because Barack Obama is president. Can you imagine if he wasn't president? We would barely be talking about these things, and the media would barely be focusing on them, even with the videotape. And it would be harder to get justice. Remember Rodney King? And I think
the only thing that I would say to that, and I understand where you're coming from with Eric, but you know, the same things that were not available to Kay and myself and people who worked actively during that era in media. We have a social media now. Everybody is a reporter. Yeah. You have a cell phone with a camera. You know, the same way that incident was memorialized the day that cop shot Walter Scott. You know, we didn't have that back then. You know,
exactly.
We talk about Eleanor Bumpers, the Diallo case, Abner Louima. If all that could have been memorialized, in some parts of this county, I mean, some parts of New York State, there's still pockets of racism. That's why Eric Garner, the grand jury, couldn't understand what was going on there. And then we have people in law enforcement right here in New York City, in Bronx County, the current, and I happen to be cordial with him, District Attorney Robert Johnson, had voted to have that Diallo case tried upstate. And I'm sorry, good friend, but I got to call him on it. You know,
right.
It is what
just
it
minute.
Is.
Just a minute. You mentioned Eleanor Bumpers. We were on the air, Wayne and I. Wayne, do you remember that? When Eleanor Bumpers, in her apartment building in New York, in Harlem, was shotgunned.
Exactly.
Okay.
82-year-old black woman.
Just for that. That's the kind of thing that makes women furious. Also, I'll tell you another thing. It was so bad in New York that the Guardians came in And remember, I had them on the air, and they would have a panel of about six people dealing with different areas that people were going through, different things from Harlem, from Brooklyn, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a black cop.
Okay.
The organization of Black Prisoners, and was the head of it was Dr. Ali Al-Rahman.
Right.
Okay. One of the finest police persons I've ever talked to, because they dealt with the problems that were. I remember when this kid, you know, kind of pulled him through a screen, you know, in Brooklyn. And they were dealing with things like that because they weren't getting any service or any, any help from the local police department because it was practically all white.
Let me just jump in here, everybody. We're remiss if we didn't take these last at least 13 minutes we have left in the show, just under 14 minutes. But you know, we have you on the show, Mr. Wesley, and I would be remiss as an actor and a fan of your work if we didn't talk to you certainly about what you've been up to. I know that you have a new show, a play that's being produced at Crossroads Theater, and tell us what you've been up to.
Well, yes, it's quite a turn.
I know.
But Autumn is the name of the new play, and in fact, it does deal tangentially with some of the political issues that we have already been discussing. Because it's a play about a transition that I think is going on inside the Black community now, and also in the national community, as we're transitioning away from the first generation of Black politicians post-civil rights to the second generation, and it's a question, and the play really starts to pose questions about what the nature of that transition needs to be, how it's going to come about, and how we as a community need to address it. And it also talks about what can happen when the people who are at the top, the people who are the elected leadership, get so hung up and so caught up in their own struggles that they forget about the people who elected them, the people whose lives are still unchanged.
Mm-hmm.
And so that dynamic is also going on in the play. And, you know, I've been working with Kevin Maynard, the head of the Trilogy Opera Company in Newark. Writing librettos for operas. We did one about Papa Doc Duvalier, the former dictator of Haiti, and I just completed one about the young men who are known collectively as the Central Park Five. The young men who were convicted, railroaded literally in the prison on charges of having sexually assaulted a jogger in Central Park, and then it turned out that none of them were involved and that they were literally browbeaten into giving false confessions and everything, and there was no evidence against them.
Richard Bridges, listen, I have to interrupt you for 1 minute. That case was covered by Anna Phillips, and she was one of the first Black reporters, I think, for either CBS or NBC at that time. That was her case. And the police knew that that the five boys, the Central Park boys, did not do that beating or whatever it was. I forget what it was with this young woman.
Yeah, it was a beating. It was a beating and a rape and a beating, yes.
These kids did not do this, and it was proven. And Anna had that information because the police department had the person who did it. We covered that in depth on WLRD, okay?
Mm.
Wayne, you were in the case.
And you've written an operetta about that.
Wow, is that what you did?
Yes, yes. We're going to try that. Kevin is trying to, he plans to do a small excerpt of it later on this summer. And then we're going to, like, mount a full production of it a little bit after that. And I'm working on another libretto for him about Jomo Kenyatta and the founding of the nation of Kenya. That's projected for later on in 2016.
Mm.
So I'm, in addition to teaching and working with young people and everything, I'm still writing. Writing plays and writing operas.
So what
opera librettos, rather.
You're teaching a screenwriting at NYU, is that correct?
Yes, I teach screenwriting, playwriting, and writing for television at NYU. And but I don't do very much screenwriting and TV writing now. I've kind of aged out of that end of the business.
In terms of writing writing screenplays,
yeah,
or things like that.
I'm at the far end of the scale, age wise, and so they generally tend to go with younger writers because of the the audience demographic that most television stations are broadcast entities are really trying to get to,
right.
And I've passed out of that.
I hate to hear that. Well, I guess you have your AARP card too, Richard, huh?
Yeah, I got it. I just got my new one in the
Yeah, we should start a campaign.
You can't show up to the meeting, Rich. You got to be a ghostwriter. They'll let them see what you look like. And then on your social media, put a younger picture of yourself.
Yeah.
Well, yeah.
That's
you know,
a damn shame. Excuse me.
Well, it's one of the joys I get out of it, out of everything now is that, for instance, my nephew is very prominent in the business. He's going to be the showrunner for this new series that's coming up on Netflix next year, based on the comic book hero Luke Cage.
Well, yeah, I have a friend that's working on that as well. What's your nephew's name? You want to give him a plug there?
Yeah, definitely. Chao Hodari Coker.
Oh, very
Chao Hodari means strong man of distinction. And he's lived
all right.
And
he is he's well known in our generation as a writer, a thinker, and a TV writer. I know he was on staff, I believe, for Empire. I thought I might have seen his name in the credits. Was that, if I'm not mistaken, Richard?
Not Empire. He did. He was on staff and an associate producer on Ray Donovan for 2 years. And he was on CSI Los Angeles for I think about 2.5 years before that. And he was one of the primary writers on another show called Southland before that. And of course, he did screenplay for the biopic on the life of the Notorious B.I.G.
Oh, really? Okay.
I think he wrote the book that the movie was based on, too. He was a journalist for a long time at XXL and The Source. I think that's where he started. And he was and for several years he was a columnist in the entertainment section for the Los Angeles Times.
Yeah.
When you consider he's only 41 years old,
yeah,
and he's done all that.
Yeah, it makes you feel like you haven't done anything at all. You know, that's very good.
Yeah, we're coming up on the end of the show, Richard. I know you're aware of the passing of Dr. Ben Wayne. My mom is pointing out that you might have some information about Dr. Ben and the arrangements for him. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Have you
Eric, another compatriot of yours, April Silver, she runs Put on Blast. She just posted an announcement about that. There is a service that's coming up very soon. Oh, my God. Oh, man.
Wayne,
tomorrow
Wayne,
Friday.
You might have
I know. The last I heard that the wake was tomorrow night at Abyssinian and Friday's the funeral. Mm. I don't know if that's changed.
That sounds consistent with what I kind of remember April, because April had put out an announcement put on blast within the last few days, and it was something similar to that. It was Abyssinian Baptist Church there in Harlem, and it was and I believe. The burial is supposed to take place by the weekend. Yeah.
With Dr. Len Jeffries last week, so I'm quite sure people still have that information. I'm quite sure they could also go on Alton Maddox's website, you know, to find out the information.
Okay.
It is as it was. It's going to be on the 8th, and et cetera, et cetera. But we're coming to the end of the show. Richard, understand that, you know, really thank you for doing this. Thank you, Wayne. Richard, we'll have to do it again.
Thank you.
Okay. Wait a
before you go, let me run down Rick and Wesley Classics. If you haven't seen them, and if you don't know, now you know Uptown Saturday Night. Let's Do It Again, two of my all-time favorites. Was it Piece of the Action 2 there, sir?
Which one?
Piece of the Action, was that yours as well, right? That was the
Piece of the Action. No. That was a brother named Charlie Blackwell. He wrote the screenplay for that one.
Okay, I see, old friend of mine. That was the least favorite one. So anyway, yours was better. That was the sequel that they shouldn't have done. So glad to hear that wasn't yours, bro.
No, that wasn't mine.
Real quickly, when does Autumn open?
Autumn opens on the 25th of April down in New Brunswick at the Crossroads Theater. Tickets are available. The featured players in it are Jerome Preston Bates, Kim Weston Moran, Count Stovall, homeboy right from here in New Jersey. Michael Chenevert, Taria Joseph, and Stephanie Berry, and Tony Salemi. They are the cast of the show. It's been directed by another New Jersey resident, Sarette Scott.
Okay. We're going to have to cut it there, Mr. Wesley, Richard, but we want to have you back. We're glad we finally got you. Want to thank you for calling in, Richard Wesley, world famous playwright, screenwriter, teacher, New Jerseyan. Thank you. Thank you to our other co-host, Mr. Wayne Gilman, legendary newsman, and Chi Chi Ronald.
Honored to be with you, Richard. And Eric and Kay.
Take good care, everybody.
All right, thank you.
We'll join you next week for Kay Thompson Live. I'm Kay Thompson. And
I'm Eric Payne on the Kay Thompson Live. So remember that you can catch us every Wednesday live at 8 to 9 p.m. on blogtalkradio.com/KayThompsonLive. And you can also listen to the show because it's archived. And that's a really good thing because you can listen to it at any time or as many times as you like. Thanks for tuning in to the Kay Thompson Live Show. This has been us. See you later. A little watermelon man for you.